All right, everybody, welcome back to the Weekend Interview Show. I'm your host, Philip Drew, Administrator, and our next guest is Gary Webb. You might remember back in the, I guess, early 90s, he wrote a very controversial series for the San Jose Mercury News called Dark Alliance, and also has written a book by the same name, Dark Alliance, the CIA, the Contras, and the Crack Cocaine Explosion. Now, I sort of apologize to everybody that this interview is kind of out of date, but, you know, I didn't have an interview show back in the mid-90s, and so we're going to go ahead and catch up and do it now. Welcome to the show, Mr. Webb.
Thanks. Glad to be here.
Now, I got to admit to you, I've been cramming as hard as I can, but I'm only about halfway through the book, so my good questions will run out when we get to about halfway through what you've written there. I guess let's start. Maybe you can explain to us how you got on this story in the first place and where your information came from that really got you going on this.
Okay. I was covering the state capitol for the San Jose Mercury News. I was in the Sacramento Bureau. And I had been covering essentially the war on drugs, which, you know, one of those great wars we've all forgotten about now that we have the war on terrorism. So, and I was covering it from the aspect of what this war on drugs is doing to our civil liberties and what it's doing to, you know, innocent people. And I had written a series of stories about asset forfeitures, which is that little program where if they think you're a drug dealer, you can lose your house, and you can lose your clothes and your car and your bank accounts, basically because they think you're a drug dealer, and you have to go to court and prove that you're not, which I thought was kind of bizarre. So I did a series on that. And as a result of that series and some follow-ups that I had written, a woman in Oakland called me and said, you know, my boyfriend is in a similar situation. He's been in jail for 3 years. He's never been brought to trial. The government's taken all of his money and all of his cash. And I think it'd be a good story. And I said, well, yeah, it is a good story, except that, you know, we've written it before, and my editors probably wouldn't be interested in reading about it all over again. And then she said, well, there's an odd part about my boyfriend's case that you might be interested in. She said one of the witnesses against him is a major cocaine trafficker who has admitted that he had worked for the CIA for a number of years bringing cocaine in the United States. And I thought, yeah, right. You know, how many times a lifetime do you get a call like this? And I said, and I had gotten plenty of crazy calls from people who said, you know, the CIA had put transmitters in my molars and were following my every move. So I was...
Well, I thought that was just an urban legend. You actually get calls from people who think they have transmitters in their molars, huh?
More than you would imagine, yeah.
That's pretty funny.
Yeah, it's pretty funny at first, and after about the fourth or fifth one, it's kind of tiresome because you have to say, look, you don't need to call me, you need to call a therapist, because I don't think that happens. Anyway, I had expressed similar skepticism to her about, oh, yeah, the CIA bringing drugs into the country. Tell me another one. And she got indignant, and she said, look, I have documents, and I can prove this, which is something you don't hear very often as a newspaper reporter. And I said, well, if you've got documents, I'd be happy to take a look at them. And so I arranged to meet her at the courthouse in San Francisco where her boyfriend was having another one of his preliminary hearings. And she showed me, essentially, one of the things she showed me was a federal grand jury transcript of some testimony of a guy named Oscar Blandone, or Danilo Blandone, his first name was Oscar, who admitted that, yes, he had worked for the Contras, which was an army the CIA that was sponsoring down in Nicaragua in the early 80s, mid-80s. And that he had gotten his start into the cocaine business by bringing cocaine into the United States and selling it for a profit and turning the profits over to the Contras. Now, this, to me, was fairly significant. First of all, because this man was under oath before a federal grand jury admitting it. And secondly, because he wasn't there because he was under indictment or being charged with anything. He was there as a government witness, which meant that the government must have believed what he said, or they wouldn't have put him on the witness stand. So I got back to my office, and I called my editor, and I said, I've got a real interesting document here. I'm not sure what to make of it, but, you know, this guy says he was bringing cocaine into the country with the CIA's knowledge, and I've never heard of that before. which by its definition would be news. And she said, well, I heard something about that during Iran-Contra, but never very much. And I said, well, why don't I just take a little time and check it out and see what it gives. I mean, you know, this guy could have a hell of a story to tell. And so she said, fine. You know, I was an investigative reporter for the Mercury, and I was used to going off and chasing down, you know, stories for months and months and months on end. So it wasn't a big request to ask for some time to go check this out. And I ended up spending a year working on it exclusively. And at the end of the year, I wrote that series called Dark Alliance. And in the meantime, got a lot more documentation. I got a lot of records classified from the Federal Archives, the FBI, and DEA. She had also gotten a lot of information of Discovery. And so we were able to put together a fairly compelling tale of this drug ring that had operated in California in the mid-80s. And not only was it bringing cocaine into the country with the knowledge of the CIA, but it was selling the cocaine to the Crips and the Blood street gangs of South Central Los Angeles, which, you know, if you remember, that was one of the scourges of America at the time. You know, these guys were on the cover of Newsweek. They were responsible for the spread of crack. They were responsible for drive-by shootings. And here we had this story that basically tied this all together and said, yeah, this is true. The Contras were selling cocaine, and they were selling it to the Crips and the Bloods, who were turning it into crack and selling it to, you know, black families and black neighborhoods all across the country.
And for your effort, you got your career destroyed, right?
Yeah, pretty much. It seems that it wasn't a very popular story. I mean, a lot of people didn't want to hear that kind of stuff.
You might be pleased to know that you got one column inch in the Austin American-Statesman about how you'd been moved to the Hollywood beat from the investigative reporter beat, and I remember thinking, all right.
Yeah,
you,
well,
man, you must have written a really great story for them to bump you all the way to the tabloid section.
Well, it was even worse than the Hollywood beat. They put me in Cupertino, which is, you know, sort of the home of computer companies, and it was like 140 miles from my house. And this comes at the end of the story. You know, the irony is that the newspaper not only... you know, when you write something like this for a major daily newspaper, it's not like you just write it and put it in the paper. You know, it goes through lawyers, it goes through layers and layers of editors, it goes through the publisher, it goes to everybody that you can think of, because basically, in this case, we were accusing the U.S. government of being complicit in a cocaine conspiracy. And that's not a charge you make lightly, especially in a, you know, a mainstream daily newspaper. So this story was pretty thoroughly vetted. We had pictures, we had documents. I mean, we put together a website, which I've put back up recently. They took it down. But it was a website that was linked to all the documents and all the tape recordings and all the classified records that we had to support our story. So we were pretty confident that, you know, we could withstand pretty much any amount of scrutiny and the story would hold up. And it did for months and months and months. And it was basically the editors of the newspaper that caved in and said, well, you know, maybe the CIA didn't really know about it, and, you know, maybe this drug ring wasn't really as big as we thought it was, and all of which was based on nothing. You know, as it turned out, the stories were more right than we even knew. You know, I ended up, you know, after I quit the newspaper, writing a book, getting a lot more information out of the government, and, you know, if I made a mistake in that story, it was underestimating the size of this drug operation and downplaying the extent of the U.S. government's knowledge of it, not hyping it, that's for sure.
All right, well, let's get into the story here now.
Okay.
All through the 60s and 70s, and for all I know before that, there was this dictator of Nicaragua named Somoza, who was
right
by the United States. And then was it 1978 that the communist revolutionary Sandinista types overthrew him?
Yeah, 78, 79, and they finally, there had been a civil war going on down there for a long time, and they finally threw out Somoza and put in their own government, which, you know, it's a right to do as an independent sovereign nation. Well, it didn't make us happy because, you know, as the United States, we were big pals of Somoza. But the Sandinistas got in, and they started doing whatever they were doing, and the United States didn't like it. And so the CIA, and it started under Jimmy Carter, but really got a push when Ronald Reagan came in. began to a covert operation to destabilize the government of the Sandinistas. So they came to the United States, and what happened was, after the Sandinistas took over, a lot of the conservative Nicaraguans and a lot of the businessmen who had been supporting Somoza fled Nicaragua and came to the United States and settled here in the country. And that's where this one drug trafficker that I started working on, this Danilo Blandón, how he happened to arrive in California. He was one of this flood of refugees from Nicaragua. And there was another man by the name of Norwin Meneses, who was basically the Al Capone of Nicaragua. He was a crime lord. And he settled in San Francisco. And these guys got together and were told by a CIA agent named Enrique Bermudez, who the CIA had picked and put in charge of the Contra Army, to raise money in California for the Contra Revolution. And both men, I mean, I interviewed Meneses in prison, and he said this happened. Blandón testified to it on the witness stand, and the CIA has also acknowledged that this meeting happened. So right at the very beginning of this drug operation, you had known drug traffickers, a major cocaine trafficker, Norwin Meneses, made international in scope. He was gigantic in scope. Meeting with the CIA, taking directions from the CIA, and following instructions to say, go to California, sell cocaine, and raise money.
Is there proof that the CIA already knew that this guy was a dope smuggler?
Yes. The CIA not only knew it, the FBI knew it, and the DEA knew it. I found CIA cables all the way back to the early 80s in which they said that, you know, he's moving cocaine here, he's moving cocaine there. The DEA had files on him that went back, I believe, to the early 70s. You know, he was a pioneer, really, when it came to international cocaine trafficking. He was dealing with the Peruvians, the Colombians, long before the cartels got started. So, he was an arms dealer, he was a murderer, he was a hitman, he was just about everything you could think of. So he was pretty dirty by the time the CIA picked him up and said, look, we need some help in financing this war, because the American public wasn't too keen on overthrowing a government that had just installed itself into power, particularly since Nicaragua had really no strategic importance to this country. When I was researching the book, I found a very funny exchange in a congressional hearing where, I can't remember, I think it was Alphonse D'Amato or somebody, was asking the Undersecretary of State for Central American Affairs, you know, what would happen if suddenly Nicaragua was given over to the communists? What would be the danger to the United States? And she said, frankly, well, I can't think of anything. So here you had this revolution in this foreign country that meant nothing to us, but it angered the CIA, and it angered the Reagan administration, who was afraid that they were going to have, you know, another Cuba in their backyard. And so they authorized the CIA to secretly overthrow the government. The problem was, you know, it takes a lot of money to run a war, and the only thing the Reagan administration had authorized was $19 million, and you can't fight any kind of war these days for $19 million. So they had to turn to other sources of income to you know, finance this thing. And the source they turned to was cocaine.
And the CIA knew that this guy Meneses was the head of this drug ring all along through the early 80s?
Oh, yeah. You know, not only that, they knew he was the head of a drug ring in Nicaragua even before the revolution. And so did the DEA, and so did the FBI. And I got DEA and FBI cables and reports and 302s to show this. So,
but they couldn't argue that, well, we knew that he used to be a dope dealer, but we didn't think he was still a dope dealer.
No, not only did he used to be a dope dealer, he continued to be a dope dealer during the entire time he was working for the CIA. And then when the CIA didn't need him anymore, he became an informant for the DEA in Central America and worked for them, and continued to sell dope until he was arrested in 1991. So he never took a break. You know, it was continuous from the early 70s to the late 90s. And for all I know, he's back down there selling dope again. So no, they can't make the argument that they didn't know who he was. The other point in that, and you know, that was argued at the time, is that, well, we really didn't realize who we were dealing with. Meneses' brother was a guy named Edmundo Meneses, who was the chief of police of Managua. And the CIA agent, Enrique Bermudez, who was meeting with Norwin, was a classmate, a close friend of Edmundo's. So he knew the family. I mean, he didn't need to know the reputation. He didn't need to know what was in the CIA's files. He knew the guy personally and knew what he was. And so did most of the Contras I interviewed who knew Manassas. They said, yeah, well, he was a drug trafficker. I went down to Nicaragua and I went back to the archives of these newspapers, and all through the 70s, there were big stories in La Prensa and other Nicaraguan papers about what a scumbag this guy was. So anybody who was literate in Nicaragua at the time knew the guy was bad news. CIA can't claim ignorance on that front.
Okay, so this guy Meneses, who's from this rich family that was tied in with Somoza,
right.
He's in exile. He goes to California, and then he's got an employee named Danilio Blandón,
right,
who does most of his dirty work for him, I guess.
Well, he doesn't do most of it. They split up the territory. Meneses ran the operation in San Francisco because a lot of the cocaine was coming into San Francisco. Blandón was coming up to San Francisco, taking the cocaine down and selling it down in Los Angeles, and running Meneses' southern operation for him. And Blandón talked about how he got his start and how he'd driven up to San Francisco and gotten 2 kilos from Meneses, went down to try to find people to sell it. And Blandón had an advantage over, I guess, other would-be drug dealers in that, you know, he had an MBA in marketing, so he knew, he knew how to sell things. You know, and the other thing he did before he came to the United States was he was a director of wholesale markets for the government of Nicaragua. So he had experience in setting up agricultural markets, which, you know, cocaine's a commodity just like, I guess, tomatoes and prunes and that sort of thing. So he had the training and he had the background, and he eventually became one of the biggest cocaine traffickers in Los Angeles. I mean, by the mid-'80s, he was moving hundreds and hundreds of kilos of cocaine per month, and the report that I saw from the DEA all said that, you know, he was one of the biggest traffickers in town. And when you're talking about L.A. in the mid-'80s, that makes him one of the biggest traffickers in the United States.
Yeah, you write in the book about how he actually got off to a pretty slow start, and then he met a guy named Rick who really saved his business, huh?
He did, because he didn't know the area, and he was dealing little bits here and there through this auto dealership he was working with, and then he had the good luck, and the rest of us had the bad luck, of him running into this guy named Freeway Ricky Ross, who was a small-time drug dealer in South Central, but a very sharp operator, and had a lot of connections to the Crips, because he grew up in a Crip neighborhood. So when he was able to get a hold of Blandón's cocaine, he was able to sort of make a market for it down in South Central. And the weird thing to me always was, you know, this was a very, very expensive drug at the time. And cocaine, I guess, relatively still is, except when you turn it into crack and you can sell it for, you know, $10, $25. And that was the variable that got thrown into this mix. Right about that time is when Rick started selling this cocaine that the Nicaraguans were providing him. He was selling it at the time when people were starting to figure out how to turn it from powder into crack. And Rick was one of the first, if not the very first, major wholesaler of crack in South Central. So he hit the market, and the Nicaraguans hit the market right at the right time historically, to create something where there had never been, you know, in South Central in the early 80s, the drugs of choice were marijuana and PCP and angel dust, that kind of stuff. There was not much of a market for cocaine because people couldn't afford it. But when the technology and the know-how to turn it into crack came along, suddenly everybody could afford it. And Rick had a guy who, this Nicaraguan Blandón, who had an endless supply of it because he was getting it from Meneses, who was getting it from the Peruvians and the Colombians, who were, you know, the manufacturers of it. So whenever Rick needed dope, he was able to get it, and he was able to get it for cheaper than any of the other dealers in town because he was getting it right from the source. And that's pretty much, you know, the cocaine business operates a lot like the car business, you know. If you know somebody that works for the Ford factory, you can get a car for a lot cheaper than, you know, down at your local dealership. Same thing's true in cocaine. If you know somebody that works for the cartels, you can get cocaine a lot cheaper than anybody else in town. And the other advantage they had, and one of the things I learned when I was researching the story, was that most of the price, you know, the difference between the price of cocaine in Bolivia and the difference of the price of cocaine in the United States is all the transportation costs. I mean, if you could get it for $100 a kilo in Bolivia, by the time you got it up here, it was $6,000 a kilo because, you know, people had to bring it up here and take a lot of risk doing it. And with the Contras and the CIA working at it, they were able to reduce the transportation costs to virtually nothing, because a lot of this stuff I found was coming up in military transport planes, and nobody was having to pay for it. So Rick not only had a very good supplier, he had a very cheap supplier, and when you've got the cheapest dope in town, there's really no loyalty among cocaine traffickers. I mean, they will buy from the cheapest guy in town. So Rick had the market in L.A. all his own for many years.
Well, and you write in your book how, in a weird kind of way, he was an angel, saving grace to South Central, that all kinds of people got put to work in good jobs, being crack mules, plenty of middle manager positions, and all of a sudden everybody's driving nice cars and buying nice guns, and this is really boom time for South Central, right?
And it really was, and a lot of people in South Central to this day regard him as sort of a Robin Hood kind of a character, because, you know, he was smart enough to take some of this money he was making, and he was making millions. I mean, it wasn't like he couldn't afford it. Taking some of the money and building basketball courts, he was building sound studios, bought a theater, and was planning on rehabbing it to give kids some place to go and practice rap music. A lot of the big rappers today got their start because Rick bought them their equipment. So, you know, when I went back and I looked at some of the old TV interviews that were done back in the 90s when Rick was finally taken down, they interviewed a lot of people in South Central who said that, you know, they thought the guy was great. He was the only guy that had ever put any money into that community, which was, you know, one of the ironies of ironies in this story, is that he put a lot of people to work that didn't have jobs. And Blandone was, you know, the guy that was responsible for it, because he was, you know, he was supplying the raw materials that they were using to create this huge industry down there that didn't exist before.
And at the same time, they're turning their customers into zombies.
Well, sure, and that was the nice thing about it from a crack dealer standpoint is, you know, it's highly addictive. So when you get somebody hooked on it, you've got a good customer for as long as their money holds out, and, you know, even beyond that, when they can start stealing stuff. So, you know, Rick had, you know, rock houses all over the place. He had, you know, people working for him on street corners all over the place. He had big dealers. He had little dealers. I mean, he was the guy. He was the dealer's dealer, essentially. And he never knew where this stuff was coming from. He had no idea who these Nicaraguans were. He had no idea what their political connections were. All he knew was that he had made connections with guys that had a lot of dope and could sell it for as little as anybody else in town, and as much as he wanted. And that's really all he cared about. You know, he was a drug trafficker. His suppliers were, you know, playing both ends. You know, they not only were selling dope, but they were using the money that Rick was giving them to buy weapons, shipping the weapons down to Central America for the Contras to use. And they were buying trucks, they were buying medical supplies, radios. They set up a company to develop laser sights for AR-15 rifles. It was really a bizarre, bizarre operation.
That brings in another CIA tie, right? What's the guy's name in the book?
Yeah, there was this guy named Ron Lister.
Yeah.
Who was a former police officer who wound up being sort of a weapons advisor to this drug ring. And there was another guy, his name is Scott something or other, his name escapes me. But both of these guys were former Navy SEALs. And you don't generally find those types around drug rings. They also had, their money launderer was a macroeconomist who was on the board of the Central Bank of Nicaragua and one of Somoza's cronies. So this was really kind of an all-star drug ring. I mean, you had a guy in San Francisco who was had connections to the cartels, the guy in L.A. who was an MBA in marketing, you had a money launderer who had a, you know, PhD in economics. You had Rick Ross, who was, you know, the biggest crack dealer in town. this is a very significant operation. It was responsible for bringing tons and tons and tons of cocaine. I mean, Blandone estimated in his own testimony that he brought in at least 4 tons. I found some reports that said it was 5 tons, and when I talked to Manessas, he said it was closer to 50 tons. So, and that's pure cocaine. I mean, when you cut it 7 or 8 times, you can just imagine the quantities of you know, crack that they were producing.
Yeah, I think at some point in your book, you do the math and say that at this point anyway, I think sometime in 83 or 84, that they were pumping out 7 million doses of crack a week.
Yeah, or a month or something. It was some ridiculous amount. Yeah, it was an enormous amount. And that's, you know, and that, and when you think about it, I mean, crack hit like this whirlwind. All of a sudden, South Central was awash in cocaine, and it had to come from somewhere. And somebody had to be making a hell of a lot of it for it to be that much around. And when I sat down and did the math, I figured, well, you know, it's not much of a mystery now to where this dope was coming from. You know, one of the guys I interviewed was one of Rick's, he was a rival at the time and later went to work for him, and he said he went to one of the cookhouses that Rick had set up down in South Central, and he said they had gutted, they bought these, you know, nondescript looking houses, and in the middle of the night they would go in and gut them, and they would bring in these big restaurant style gas ranges and, you know, big cooking pots, and they would have people in there 24 hours a day just cooking crack. And he had several of these houses all over the place. And they were just making, you know, Rick was talking about making $2-3 million a day in profit is the amount of cocaine he was selling. So, you know, it staggers the imagination sometimes to think of how big that operation was.
Okay, so I could see Bermudez, the CIA handler, I guess, of Manessas, and maybe even William Casey, people in the CIA at the top levels knowing about this. But is there any evidence that Colonel North and the Vice President George Bush and people like that knew about what was going on here? Or is this
a lot of evidence
all lower down?
There was a lot of evidence that North knew about it. There were references when his diaries were finally declassified. There were references in his diaries to needing plane to go pick up cocaine paste. The strongest evidence that North knew about it comes from a bunch of memos that were sent to him by a guy who was working for him in Central America named Rob Owen, who was the CIA informant for the Costa Rica station down there. And he was telling him point blank that this Contra leader's selling drugs, this Contra leader's dealing in the black market, this Contra leader's dealing in cocaine. And these all showed up during the Iran-Contra hearings and later during North's trial. So there's very little dispute that North knew the Contras were dealing drugs. As far as Bill Casey goes, you know, there is one of the things that we found after the series came out was this thing called a Memorandum of Understanding that was signed in the very early 80s. I think 81, between Bill Casey, who was then head of the CIA, and William French Smith, who was then head of the Department of Justice. And it was a weird little memo that said basically, from now on, any CIA employee or agent who is suspected of narcotics crimes no longer needs to be reported to the Justice Department. The previous laws said that, you know, if you got word that you were having people who were working for you were dealing drugs, you had to report them. All this memo did was say you no longer had to report them. Now, when you think about it, why in the world would they do that? You know, unless they were contemplating the use of cocaine as a financing device for this Contra operation, because the timing of this memo coincides with the beginning of the war in Nicaragua. It also coincides with the beginning of the covert war that they were also running at the same time in Afghanistan with the Mujahideen. And as we know now, the Mujahideen was very heavily involved in financing that operation through the sale of opium and heroin. You know, Afghanistan is now one of the leading, I think it even may be the leading heroin producer in the world. Which it wasn't, you know, until the CIA got over there and decided to run a similar operation that they were running in Nicaragua.
This is so the same kind of thing that they ran in Vietnam, too, the Golden Triangle, right?
It's exactly the same kind of thing. And I even found a precedence going back to the Korean War. There were some records declassified a couple of years ago that talked about how an agent who was working for the CIA in Korea had made millions and millions and millions of dollars dealing drugs with a North Korean. So, you know, it goes back, you know, and that was the strange thing about the reaction to the story when it came out. It was like people said, oh, this is unheard of. Well, no, it's not, if you know a little bit about the history of this kind of thing.
I can't remember her first name. There's a book about Iran-Contra called Out of Control by...
Leslie Cobert. Yeah.
Yeah, there you go. And she talks about in there how the CIA guys and the ex-military guys and whoever that were running the covert war down there in Nicaragua, it was the exact same group of people who'd been running all the secret operations in Laos and Cambodia, and that
they just had a new jungle
to play in.
Yeah, a lot of the pilots and a lot of the, remember that fellow Eugene Hassenfuss? He was shot down. It was basically the thing that started the whole Iran-Contra scandal.
Right.
The Sandinistas blew the C-5A out of the air, and the only guy that survived the crash was this cargo kicker named Eugene Hassenfuss, who parachuted to safety and was captured. And when he was captured, he was asked who he was and told his name, and he said, what do you work for? And he said, well, I work for the CIA. I work for Air America. Well, you know, the CIA wasn't supposed to be down in Nicaragua at the time because, you know, we had this little thing called the Boland Amendment, which Congress said, you know, no CIA, no Department of Defense money is to be going to this covert war. And voila, suddenly you have guys working for the CIA getting shot out of an airplane down there. And Hassenfuss had worked for Air America in Vietnam. Richard Secord had worked for Air America in Vietnam. It was exactly the same bunch. And they just shifted their operations. And, you know, it's pretty well known now. It's heavily denied at the time, and when the stories came out, it was heavily denied. But Air America was being used to ferry, opium and heroin out of the Golden Triangle during Laos and Cambodia and Vietnam and that sort of thing. So.
And you think the same thing's going on right now in Afghanistan?
Well, the same thing was definitely going on in Afghanistan during the 70s and 80s,
right.
When we were, you know, helping Osama bin Laden and those guys overthrow the Soviet Union, or kick the Soviet Union out of that country, they were definitely financing that operation.
The Taliban, when they took power, they completely eradicated the opium crops, and now that we've taken the country back over again, like you say, they're back on the top of the list of opium-producing countries.
Yeah, and I'm sure it's all a coincidence. I'm sure it's all a coincidence. I don't want anybody to draw any conclusions from that, but, history always repeats itself, and, it's just astonishing to me that nobody can put two and two together and say, every time the CIA goes in somewhere, drug trafficking, you know, escalates. And especially in Central America, I mean, a lot of these countries, like Costa Rica, there was no drug problem at all down there before this Nicaragua war started. And suddenly, you know, people in San Jose were turning into crack addicts, and nobody could figure out how. I mean, San Jose, Costa Rica was the first place in Central America that had crack. And it just so happened to be the nerve center of the covert war on the Southern Front down there. It's pretty transparent when you put all the pieces together and look at it. But.
It's interesting to me that, I guess through the 90s, I guess is when I first noticed this, that a lot of people on the left will talk about your book and point to government drug dealing in L.A., and that kind of thing, and some people on the right, maybe you got to go pretty far to the right to find them, but there's some people on the right who talk a lot about drug dealing and CIA goings-on in Arkansas in the 80s,
yeah.
I guess mostly just because there's such anti-Clinton types, and it takes a libertarian like me to say, hey, I know, I wonder if the crack going on in L.A. that Gary Webb is talking about and all the cocaine coming into Arkansas that people like Terry Reed are talking about, I wonder if this is the same story.
It is exactly the same story, and it is just a different arm of the same pipeline. I mean, you know, one of the interesting things that I have yet to see brought up in this current campaign, back in, I think it was 86 or 87, John Kerry, the guy that's now running for president, held a series of hearings on the issue of Contras and cocaine, and concluded in a very, very thick book that the Contras were dealing drugs they were bringing in the United States. Kerry's investigation was focused on the East Coast. There was a major drug pipeline that was coming out of Miami, and part of it was one arm of that drug pipeline was the stuff that was going into the MENA airport in Arkansas. Now, there's been a lot of speculation that Clinton knew about it. Frankly, this guy Dan Lassiter, who was one of Clinton's buddies, major campaign financiers, is a convicted cocaine trafficker. Clinton's brother is, a known cokehead. And nobody ever stopped to think, well, how did this happen? How did Clinton get to be such buzz with such a major drug dealer as Dan Lassiter? And, well, the answer is Lassiter was part of that operation down there. The only people that have written about that, like you said, Terry Reid, the Wall Street Journal editorial page, a guy named Mika Morrison wrote a number of articles about this, all these strange goings on down there. And Alex Coburn in The Nation had written some stories about this company called Parkon Meter. It was down in Russellville, Arkansas, that had these strange government contracts. They were involved with drug trafficking at that end of the operation as well.
And we got a big problem here if, like the reports say are true, that, this thing was really being run out of George Bush's office more than out of Ronald Reagan's office. And then, if he and Clinton were cooperating in the same cocaine ring, and then they ran against each other as president in 1992...
Well, it's, I'll tell you what, when my story came out in 96, the Democrats weren't all that eager to, I thought, naively, that, since this involves the Reagan-Bush administration, this would be something the Democrats in Congress would seize upon happily and hold hearings and want to get to the bottom of. Well, nobody really wanted to get to the bottom of. The only person that did was Maxine Waters, who represented South Central, because this is where all the drugs were going, but she couldn't get anybody interested in holding some real hearings on this thing. The only investigative hearings Congress held on this whole matter was held by the House Intelligence Committee, and most of those hearings were closed, and all of them were run by this guy named Porter Goss, who was an ex-CIA agent. So how thorough an investigation do you think it's going to be when you've got the CIA investigating itself, basically? And that's all that was ever done. I mean, the CIA Inspector General did an internal investigation and released a couple of reports, half of which are still classified, by the way. Now, the Department of Justice did an investigation, half of which is still classified.
Well, the nation wouldn't be secure if we all knew that they were dope dealers.
Well, no. I mean, and I think people would be outraged, and rightly so, that we're spending billions of dollars on this war on drugs on one hand, and on the other hand, we're helping it come into the country.
That's true. This was the era of just say no and all the big Reagan anti-drug campaigns.
This was right. It was right at the same time, and the cynic in me says this was started to avert suspicion that the Reagan administration could have anything to do with illegal drug trafficking because they were the just say no administration, right?
Of course not. They would never do something as immoral as that.
No, they would do like Iran-Contra and that sort of thing, and they'll fess up to trading weapons with the Ayatollah, but as far as sending cocaine down, and then we can't forget Manuel Noriega, who is our good buddy down in Panama, convicted cocaine trafficker, longtime CIA agent. Nobody said boo about him until, we decided to get rid of him. And then suddenly, oh my God, we've got a drug trafficker down in Panama, let's invade the country. Well, shit, the CIA knew about that for years. There have been books written about how long Noriega was a known money launderer and known narcotics trafficker. And a lot of the people working for Noriega were also working for the Contras in Costa Rica. So,
did George Bush Sr. know about all this? Is there ties between all the CIA and the vice president's office?
George Bush Sr. was a lot more involved in the covert operations down in El Salvador than he was in Nicaragua.
It was the same operation, though, wasn't it?
It was part of the same operation, yeah. And my personal opinion is, yeah, Bush knew a whole lot about it. Nobody seemed all that eager to put him on the spot. And, there was that great memo that Now, there was a CIA agent named Felix Rodriguez who was running around setting up things down in Ilopango Airport down in El Salvador.
Well, he's the guy that killed Che Guevara, right?
Yeah, same guy. And, you know, friends with this guy, Philippe Vidal, who's another, you know, cocaine trafficking CIA agent. He went down there and set the airlift operation up at Ilopango, which the Contras were using to transship drugs. Came back to Washington, had a meeting with Bush, and they got a copy of the agenda, the Iran-Contra investigators did, and the agenda said resupply of the Contras. Well, that was illegal, right? Bush was able to convince the press that, no, this memo really said resupply of the choppers, and the Contras was a typo, and so they really didn't really have anything to do with Contras at all, and the press bought it.
Yeah, that's what they call the rule of law, right?
Yeah, it's the golden rule. He who has the gold makes the rules. So, you know, yeah, it's pretty obvious. You know, Rodriguez was reporting back to Bush pretty regularly on what was going on down there. Rodriguez was up to his eyeballs in that resupply operation in Ilopango. There were two hangars at Ilopango. There was hangar number 5 and hangar number 6. Hangar number 5 was the CIA's. Hangar number 6 was the National Security Council's. They're right next door to each other. There are memos that came out after my stories came out about a DEA agent named Celerino Castillo, who was the DEA agent assigned to El Salvador. He had written memos back in the 80s about drug trafficking being done out of hangars 5 and 6. State Department got wind of it, sent cables to the CIA, sent cables to the DEA, and said, get this guy off the case. They yanked Castillo out of El Salvador, basically because he discovered what was going on down there and reassigned him. So no investigation was ever done, but the government knew about it, and we could prove that now. So, yeah, it boggles the mind to think that Bush didn't know what was going on down there. Ollie North sure knew what was going on down there. Donald Gregg knew what was going on down there, and Felix Rodriguez knew what was going on down there, and all those guys were in contact with Bush's office.
So how long did this operation go on from, 1979 through, 84, 85?
It went on, I mean, Manessas was a drug dealer from before that, so if you're talking about this operation, let's limit it to specifically this operation being done to supply money for the Contras.
Right.
It went on from 81 to approximately 88, and then continued on its own after 88 when it was no longer needed. They continued it on until Norwin Manessas got busted in Nicaragua in 91, and Blandón got busted in San Diego in 92. But Blandón, you know, did 24 months in jail and got out. I mean, and this was for a lifetime of cocaine dealing and admitting selling 4 tons. He did 24 months and got out and went to work for the DEA, and still works for the DEA to this day, as far as I know. The Nicaraguan courts were a little harsher with Manessas when they caught him with 750 kilos. They sent him 12 years in jail, and he just got out a couple of years ago.
Wow, so this lasted all the way until the early 90s, but the Iran-Contra scandal broke in 85, right?
Yeah. See, this was the unlooked-at part of the Iran. You know, the Iran-Contra scandal had three parts. It had weapons, it had the hostages, and it had the cocaine. The only thing Congress ever looked at was the weapons and the hostages, and did everything in its power to keep anybody from going into the cocaine angle. This was shunted off to John Kerry. John Kerry's investigation was like ridiculed and ignored. Part of it was given to Lawrence Walsh, who was the Iran-Contra special prosecutor, but Walsh had no authority to go in and look at drug trafficking. His authority was limited by the directions he got from the court, which was just to look at Oliver North and his dealings with the weapons and the overcharging for the missiles to Iran. So nobody ever investigated the third leg of this duel that was the Iran-Contra investigation, except for John Kerry. And nobody paid any attention to what Kerry's investigation found. Newsweek sort of dismissed him as like a conspiracy theorist.
Yeah, the Skull and Bonesman is the conspiracy theorist. I love it.
Yeah, you know,
it's great.
It's a useful label to put on somebody when you want to sort of marginalize them or discredit them.
Sure.
Because if what Kerry did find had become widespread public knowledge, it would have been a disaster for the Reagan administration, because that was right at the time they were trying to persuade us, look, the Contras need another $100 million. You know, they're on the verge of victory. We can't abandon them now, blah, 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 blah. Kerry's investigation came along at a very inconvenient time because, you know, it would have ruined the Reagan administration's Contra plan if it had come out.
And they weren't anywhere near the edge of victory, by the way. I mean, from what I can tell, the Contra Army was just a bunch of guys, a bunch of gangsters making money and not doing anything.
That's a good, fair assessment of what they were, yeah. They never had a chance of winning down there. Never. And, you know, when you look back at the memos that North was writing and the memos that his buddy Rob Owen was writing, and you look at the testimony and the trials, you know, it's pretty clear that nobody held any hope that that revolution, that counter-revolution, was going to do anything except be sort of a minor pain in the neck to the Sandinistas. But it was good PR. It showed the American public that we were, you know, concerned about communism. You know, I don't know if you remember this, but Reagan at one point said, you know, if they take over Nicaragua, the next stop is Harlingen, Texas. So, you know, it was a scare campaign. It was just, you know, the continuation of the Cold War. Today, nobody would make any bones about it, but, you know, this was a different time. A very scary time, you know. I think when historians finally get a good enough distance from the 80s, they're going to look back to it as sort of one of the low points in American history.
Yeah, we seem to just be getting lower and lower.
Well, yeah, you know, I don't see much improvement, but I don't know if, well, you know, nobody knew what the Reagan administration was doing either. I mean, I don't know if the Bush administration now is actively trafficking in drugs, but the Reagan administration certainly was.
And neither of us will be shocked when it comes out in 2 years that they were.
Well, no, you know, my rule of thumb in these kinds of things is that it'll take you 20 years to figure out what your government is doing today. In 20 years, ultimately, the truth comes out. And by then everybody will go, oh my God, that's terrible, but glad we're not doing it anymore. But every 20 years we say that, and every 20 years we find out we are doing it still. I think the crime I committed in doing my series was I was like 10 years too early. You know, if this has come out, maybe not. I mean, this was such a horrible thing. You know, I think it would have been shocking no matter when it came out. The shocking part, at least to me, the most shocking part, was not that the Contras were dealing drugs, because there was widespread suspicion that they were back in the 80s, but where they were dealing them. You know, I don't think anybody had a clue that they were going down to South Central and selling them to the ghetto.
Which brings up the racism angle. I know a lot of the publicity about your book focused on, and about the series in the San Jose Mercury News, focused on how, you know, all this was going straight into South Central. You know, Manessas apparently wasn't setting up operations in Cincinnati, Ohio, Whitey.
Although Rick later did set him up in Cincinnati, and he was using Manessas' cocaine to do it, but that was only because he had to leave L.A. because the cops. You know, one of the things that was unfortunate about the public reaction to the series is a lot of it said, aha, the CIA invented crack to decimate black America. That was the conclusion a lot of people drew from it. That was not a conclusion that I reached, and that's not something I ever believed. I mean, I don't think the CIA gave a damn where this cocaine was being sold. I don't think they even wanted to know. What they wanted was the money.
But you kind of got tarred as though you were making that accusation, which people wouldn't even entertain.
Well, yeah, because a lot of people took this up and said this proves that one of the things that I ran into was that there's been this widespread belief in the African American community that, you know, not just during the 80s, but even during the 60s, the FBI was bringing drugs in. Well, you know, they weren't far wrong. the CIA knew this stuff was going into South Central. I mean, there were reports that were done in 86 and 87 by the LA County Sheriff's Department, which showed very clearly that, you know, this stuff was going into South Central. They knew where it was coming from. The CIA knew about it because we found reports that showed they did. But there's a big difference between, you know, malign neglect and overt action. And in this case, the CIA just didn't care. It's not a situation where they sat down and said, okay, let's invent something that's going to make zombies out of African Americans so we can, you know, move in and have them kill themselves. They didn't need to do that. And frankly, that gives the CIA way too much credit for its planning capabilities. I mean, they've never planned a conspiracy that worked that well. And you could see, you know, the stuff we're hearing today about, you know, how they managed to miss the fact that Hussein had no weapons of mass destruction. It doesn't speak highly of the agency's intelligence, frankly. And I always told people that, you know, if this is what the CIA did, this is by far the only thing they've ever done that's worked.
Well, in that 10-year period, I'm sorry, let me go back here. The See, I only got halfway through the book, so I was kind of shocked that...
Well, I don't blame you.
I was kind of shocked to find that, you know, to hear you say that, you know, this went on all the way up and through 1992. And I wonder, how many examples are there of federal prosecutors and FBI agents who weren't in the loop? How many times did they try to bring charges against these guys, only to find that they were protected by higher up?
Well, there was the one... The first example I found was... in San Francisco, in the DEA office there, in the very early 80s, a female DEA agent named Sandra Smith stumbled onto this operation. And she got very close. She got the Manessas, because I got her reports under the Freedom of Information Act. She was very, very close to the bust in this thing. And they actually raided some of the Manessas' houses. But somebody tipped them off. And after these raids came up empty, they yanked her off the case and reassigned her to go after the Hells Angels motorcycle gang. So that was the first one. The second one was in El Salvador, when I mentioned earlier that the DEA agent discovered what was going on at Ilopango and tried to investigate the drug trafficking that was going on out of those Contra hangars and the CIA hangars down there, and he got yanked off. And that was roughly about the 85, 86. The people who got the closest was the LA County Sheriff's Office. They had a group called the Majors, which was short for Major Violators. These guys were some hard-ass hombres. You know, they were really after the big Colombian cocaine cartels. They were after the big money launderers, and they discovered this Contra drug ring. And I was able to get all of their internal documentation, and they had this thing nailed. And they went out, and they raided like 14 places, and every single one of them was dry. Somebody had tipped them off.
This is the one I remember reading about this in Esquire, where they quote the LAPD guy as reading your story and saying, "Hey, this shit is true." And he brings up that anecdote of the 14 crack houses raided at once when they were all met with coffee and donuts.
Yeah, and they said, "Well, it took you so long. You know, we were expecting you an hour ago."
Nice.
And there was, you know, there was a lot of investigation done after that raid failed, and nobody ever really pinned down who the leak was. But the cops that were on it, who I interviewed, suspected very strongly that it was the CIA who had tipped Blandone off. But he got away with it. He got out of that one. He relocated to Florida, and so he skipped out on that. And then the FBI office in San Francisco for many, many years, I'll give the FBI credit, they were after Norman Manessas for a long time. And they indicted him, and the Justice Department persuaded them to seal the indictment, which is still sealed to this day. Because he was then working as an informant for the DEA. The only people that ever busted these guys were the Nicaraguan police, and they got Manessas. Blandone got caught. I've never believed that Blandone got caught. I believe Blandone was brought in through the artifice of being set up on a drug sting. Because the case against him, when I looked at the documents, was very, very weak. And he pleaded out almost immediately, and then he went and worked for the DEA. And I think the only reason that happened is because he was about to get busted by somebody else who was not part of this loop that was protecting him. So, you know, and he's a federal informant now. He's making a lot of money. So crime, I mean, the bottom line is crime does pay. I mean, the only guy that's in jail is Rick Ross, who was like the third man on the totem pole. He was the, you know, the black guy that was dealing their dope. The two guys that were selling it to him skipped.
Yeah, and he's doing life without parole now, right?
Well, he was doing life without parole. He appealed that, and he got it reduced to 20 years to life, and I think it's been reduced again. Because the case against him was based on the word of this guy, Blandone, who was a worse criminal than Rick Ross ever was. And not only that, he was in the country illegally at the time. So, you know, he had a drug conviction, and by law, you're not allowed to bring people who have drug convictions in the United States when the federal government was letting them fly in and out of the United States all the time. So Ross's attorney found out that he was here setting up Rick Ross illegally, and I think people got embarrassed, and they reduced the case. And I think Rick's supposed to get out in a couple of years, so, you know, we'll see. But he's, as far as I know, he's still in prison.
Man.
American justice.
Yeah. Like you were saying,
makes you proud to be an American, doesn't it?
Crime pays as long as you work for the state. You can kill,
well,
and steal whatever you want.
As long as you're a big enough criminal. You know, if you're a small timer, it doesn't pay. When you get into that weird area where, you know, a guy did a book called The Underground Empire many years ago, James Mills, and it talked about this world where governments and criminals intersect, and that's the area you need to get into if you're going to be a criminal and make a lot of money, is you need to get up into that strata where you're protected, as this drug ring clearly was protected. So,
go ahead. I'm sorry.
No, that's all I was going to say.
Who do you write for now?
I write for a variety of publications. I've written for Esquire, I've written for Vibe, I've written for Yahoo Internet Life, I write for Asia Times, I'm writing right now, I just did a piece for High Times magazine, and I'm doing another one. And High Times, I don't know if you know, has changed. It's no longer a pot magazine, it's they've changed it into some, you know, journal of culture and that sort of thing, and they're trying to...
They still have really pretty buds on the cover.
Well, not the last cover I saw. They had female bodies on the cover, which is a new one on me.
Oh, there you go.
But yeah, they've tried to, or at least they're trying to. And some people that I know bought it, and so I'm doing some writing for them. Mostly, I work for the California Legislature doing government oversight investigations. You know, I got out of the newspaper business because I was so disgusted with what happened with the Mercury. And went to work for is basically a government investigator.
What's your website where people can find out, read the links to the newspaper series and get the book?
Well, I can give you the website. It's easier just to enter, you know, Dark Alliance or my name into a search engine,
yeah,
and it'll pop it up.
Cool.
But for people that don't want to do that, the website address is http gary.webb.home.comcast.net.
Cool. gary.webb.home.comcast.net.
Right. And that'll get you the original webpage of the Mercury News posted, along with links to a lot of the stories that were written about the series and a whole bunch of other stuff. I basically tried to collect everything that had been written about the series and put it on the website so people could see what kind of reaction it prompted.
That's an excellent book. I got to say, I'm not quite through with it yet, but it's a great.
Well, thanks very much. Yeah, it's still in print, which is kind of unusual for a book that was written like, I don't know, 6-7 years ago. And you know, I'm still doing college lectures on it, and I teach it in journalism school, and it was a very amazing experience to me. Still is kind of an amazing experience because I was a reporter for spent all my working life. And, you know, thought that if you wrote the truth, that's all you needed to worry about. Well, ain't so.
Ah, sweet naivete.
Yeah, it is. It is. It wises me up pretty quick.
All right. Well, we're out of time. Do you have any closing comments or anything?
I generally don't, no.
All right. Well, everybody, Gary Webb is the author. The book is Dark Alliance. And the website is gary.webb.home.comcast.net. Thank you very much for coming on the show. It's been great.
Well, thank you very much for having me. I've appreciated it.
Sure.